If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
So, in the most predictable turn of events since the dawn of time, Manchester City blew their good start at Wolves by getting beaten 2-0 when Spurs came to town at the weekend. Why weren't they able to control the game? Why were they their own worst enemy? Is it just a small bump in the road, or do we need to sound the alarms and flag down a black cab to Panic Lane? Answers, hopefully, coming up in today's Blue Moon podcast. One thing that we can say for sure is that a defeat in the first two games of the season isn't the end of the world. We've been looking at City's successful years when they've had an early loss. That's coming up. Then it's Brighton up next as the tricky start to the season continues. Dan Burke has been speaking to Ryan Adsett from Talk Seagulls to find out how things are going down at the Amex. That's all on the way, but first we've got to perform the post-mortem on Saturday's game. I'm David Mooney, and donning the latex gloves and picking up the scalpels with me is from statcity.co.uk, Adam Carter.
Hello.
And from the City Ramble podcast, Joe Butterfield.
Hello. I was concerned when you mentioned latex gloves, and I was wondering where this was going to go, but thankfully we're all right.
Yeah. Adam, your scalpeling hands ready and eager to get into the carcass that is Saturday's game?
Disinfected, scrubbed down, ready to go straight in.
Excellent. Right. Before we get to all of that, a quick question to kick us off. David Silva was seen in the old Wembley 99 kit recently. So, nice and simple. Which old kit would you think would suit the current players? Which one would you like to resurrect for the current stars? Adam, please tell me that you've got your eye on the laser blue from 1997.
I'm surprised you said that. What a picture it was, by the way, David Silva. That just went straight on the Instagram. That's 100%. A timeless classic, that one. And if we hadn't already resurrected the 99 kit, that would absolutely have been my answer. But my first one was the 97 laser, but I'm going for the 2009-10 Umbro first blue home shirt. My favourite.
You mean the most perfect home kit ever?
Exactly. So why would I look past that? And I'm worried now that was like our era kit, and that's now becoming retro. So that's just showing my age.
Like,
exactly. Absolutely that, though. No.
Can I make you feel worse about it?
Go on.
2009-10, first season of the podcast. This is the 17th year.
Wow. There we go. Wow. Good omen, though.
Yeah. Joe, over to you. Any favourite kits that you'd like to see resurrected for the current players? Who would what would Ruben Dias look good in? I mean, a bin bag. Other than that, but
I think Ruben Dias typically looks all right when he's wearing nothing at all. Really, nothing at all, nothing at all.
Nothing at all. Yeah.
He's So at first I was going to say something stupid and say the infamous Man City kit that just had no badge and just the word Man City over the front.
Do not do that. That's still in recent memory.
It's too recent. Again, the treble home kit. I would love if there was some way that you could just freeze one kit
that
just
forever.
Forever home kit. Yeah. That's the one you'd pick, isn't it?
I agree.
But the one that I like is the, I think it was the, was it the 10-11 maroon kit, or that might be the 11-12? I can't remember which one it is. But I know they obviously had like a maroon kit of some description last season. Although it was
I think we're thinking of the same one. If I say Dzeko at West Brom,
yes,
or
Fulham. Yes, that's the one there. So I think, and obviously we had a variant of that last season, although it was a bit of like extra patterning on there that looked a bit bizarre. But that maroon kit was just so like, I think Umbro was just, they just made such clean kits. It was brilliant. It was so good. And then obviously we moved to Nike and we all thought, oh, this is the big time. And we just got templates for 7 years.
Yeah. If I was going to go back, I'd probably go for the 97 home laser blue, but also the away kit that was like dark blue on top with the maroon bar with the white around it. So that's I'd go back to my childhood from the 90s. You know, the football wasn't good, but the kits were great. speaking of the football not being good, let's get into this game, Adam. I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Yeah. Seamless that was. If we hadn't even referenced the joins there, nobody would have noticed them.
Sorry.
We've been here before. Home defeat to Spurs. It happens season on season. How much was this like those, or was it a different style of home defeat to Spurs? Was it a completely new flavour of crisp that we're eating here?
Exactly. So it's the same packet, but the ingredients are slightly different. Let's say that.
Different brand of crisps. Yeah.
Exactly. We were great in the opening 40 seconds. We looked at it. We were pressing. I thought, oh, we're bang on it here. We're not going to have the usual Spurs. So that's why the ingredients start different. Obviously, if we're going to carry on those analogies, it was a complete new playing staff. So I was hopeful that it wasn't going to be the same old. So yeah, like I say, we started well. We were zipping about. We had three big chances before they had their first. So in that respect, I thought we were looking. That's what was different about it. In years gone by, we've just not seemed at the races at all. And this seemed we were at the races for at least the first 20% of the game, shall we say. And then it all just kind of, we just struggled to beat their press. We struggled to live with their press on us as well. And like we struggled to match what we'd done in those opening minutes. So it's very much Pep 2.0 and City 2.0 now. So that's why where it felt different for me in terms of the old Spurs, but obviously the result was still the same, and just gutted because, like I say, opening 40 seconds, I'm here for. We'll win the league on that form.
Yeah. I mean, we'll get into the goals and stuff in a bit, Joe, but I mean, like Adam said there, Spurs pressed really, really high and really didn't let City keep possession in any meaningful sense. Guardiola said afterwards that he picked Cherki instead of Bernardo because he was expecting a bit more of a low block and a bit more need to unlock Spurs. Is it a bit concerning just how much control City didn't have of this game? With the speed at which Spurs were pressing high, if City could have got the ball through them, there were chances to be had there, but they just couldn't get out.
Yeah, it was really rough sort of watching the team try to put a sort of coherent passage of play together to break through. Because I think they did a good, Carragher did a good analysis of it on Monday Night Football, where he looked at how Spurs used basically their centre-backs to press. They kept the full-backs at the back, presumably to sort of attempt to nullify any counter-attacks as they're the pacier players. Obviously, Van der Ven's probably the fastest they've got, but he's also so aggressive that they moved those aggressive players into our half to sort of harass our midfield effectively, for lack of a better phrase. Obviously, that Haaland free kick that he gave away on the edge of our box pretty early on when he sort of had that poor control and then he just like it bounced away from him and he took a bit of a lazy tackle at it, basically. That was Christian Romero on the edge of our box having just competed with Haaland for the ball. That's a level of press that they were doing. So it's kind of, in that sense, understandable that City found that difficult to deal with. It's not something they'll have come up against very much before. It was really good from Thomas Frank to sort of come up with that way of dealing with things. But yeah, the midfield selection was bizarre to me. It felt like in a world that we're in where, you know, a lot of people, there was a lot of talk of, oh, City are back after we beat Wolves 4-0. And that's obviously kind of the thing you are going to get after you have a really high scoreline, even if it is against a team that look like they're probably going to be in and around the relegation zone, looking at their sort of performances they've had so far. We should be thinking Pep should be thinking of this in a more, if it ain't broke, don't fix it way to start the season. Like, you've got a team that put in a really good performance against Wolves. And look, Spurs are a different beast to Wolves, obviously, but Bernardo played really well against Wolves, and he obviously offers a bit more protection of the back four playing alongside Nico G, who for me isn't at the point where he can play as a lone six. So it feels like having him there with Reinders and Marmoush playing as more advanced midfielders ahead of him against a counter-attacking side like Spurs felt like a bit of a recipe for disaster in a lot of ways. But it was a midfield three that had never played together and had never started a game together, and you could very much tell, and that's probably no doubt a huge factor in why we couldn't really control the game in any meaningful way, really.
Yeah, this is a young City team as well, Adam. I saw the stat that this is the youngest City team since 2010, and like that has to be some mitigation in the performance as well. They are still learning what Guardiola wants from them, and that, like, they were exploited on the day, and like you said there, on the day, like, that could be an entirely different game. City weren't really at the races for a long spell in that game, but Marmoush gets clean through and misses a one-on-one. You know, Haaland has a header right before half-time that could make it 2-1, change the game. Like, Spurs give it away in their own penalty area, and somehow Haaland doesn't find Cherki in the middle. Like, there's all these chances that City are creating when they're not really at the races. So, like, give them a bit more experience, a bit more time together, and, like, no reason to panic, I guess.
Yeah, and the two other chances, I can think Reinders should have turned inside when he went back out again when he was clean through. Rodri had a header from the corner. But in terms of, so we can, the fact that we're able to reel off these chances means we were creating something, even having this such a young squad, having such a difficult opposition, such a tactical masterclass between Thomas Frank, or a battle between Frank and Pep. But I've said on the way to the ground, we need to give this team 6 months to bed in. Now, funny, when at the end of the game, I'm fuming because of the performance. And the uncle said, but before the game, you were saying we had 6 months to bed in. But in
yeah,
in
yeah, it's going to be like this till March, lads.
Yeah, yeah. In the real world, you don't get 6 months to bed in, because I think every other team is strengthened now. So that this the fact that they're so young and they genuinely do need time to bed in, where we're at now in what we've achieved over the last 10 years, you don't get that bedding period anymore, unless it's a categoric statement from the club to say, look, we're in a transition period, and they need to dampen expectations. But they're not going to do that, are they, because of the money involved, the sponsorship involved. And like I say, that isn't the real world, that you can just get all your young, youthful players time and a nice, happy path to get into the top of the league. So I know that's never going to happen. So having said that, the reason I said before the game they need time is because of that age. You've got Trafford, whose home debut is against a Spurs side that are pressing like mad, when he's learning to play the ball out from the back, which I think, I know we'll probably get onto that in a bit, but that was probably I think it was the right thing to do. He's being coached to play that way, so then you can't jump down his neck when he messes up like that. He's not Ederson, so that's going to happen. So there's the age highlighted there. The way Cherki was around the edge of the box, he wasn't necessarily making the decisions that a De Bruyne might have done when he was trying to force it, but forcing it at the right times. Or did De Bruyne have a bit more credit in the bank than these young players have, that when he's trying to force it, we allow it? When these young players are trying to find their feet and trying to find their way into the game, they've not got the credit in the bank to fall back on when they're trying these things that aren't working. So they need to hit the ground running straight away. You've got Oscar Bob coming back from long-term injury. The fact that we're able to reel these excuses off, our reasons, shall I say, out, take it out. Yeah. That answers the question that, you know, it was a young team, and these type of things are going to take time to bed in. Whether you're allowed it or not is a different debate.
I was going to say, you look at the starting lineup, the settled players in that team. You've got Ruben Dias, John Stones, Rico Lewis is you know, still been there a couple of seasons, yeah. Still younger player, yeah. Though. And Erling Haaland, the rest of them are either new youngsters or like have just come off the back of a long-term injury. So it's like, it is, you know, a lot's got to be built around that.
Another thing on that as well is that in terms of just sheer number of games played, like, this was Spurs' ninth game since returning from the summer. They've had 6 pre-season friendlies, the Super Cup against PSG, and then their second Premier League game being us. We came back from summer, had 1 pre-season friendly against Palermo, and then these 2 Premier League games, and that's it. And that's kind of, and that's a decision that City and Pep make, where they effectively treat the first 2 to 3 months of the season as quote unquote pre-season in that sense. They prefer to have the time on the training ground at the start of in the summer rather than overloading with friendlies and stuff like that. But you know, it showed in the end. Like, Spurs looked like a team that was more match ready. They looked like a team that was more tactically understanding of what they were supposed to do. As you know, even the new signings that they've made sort of are a part of the team now that look like they've been there for what, I mean, most of their 11 anyway was last season's 11. It's just sort of getting used to Frank's system. So yeah, it's I mean, when you think about it that way, it's no wonder that one side looked like it was, you know, a good couple of yards ahead of the pace of what we had.
Yeah. Well, let's touch on the goalkeeper then, Joe, as well, because it was a great debut from Trafford at Wolves, couple of good saves, and certainly the one that was offside that he didn't know about that he didn't know the flag had gone up for. There is now a lot of heat on him after that Spurs game. Obviously, he made the error for the second goal a couple of times, a bit nervy coming off his line, didn't really know whether he should come or stay. What do you make of the situation with the goalkeepers right now? Because Edison might leave, still might not leave. We don't know what's going to happen there. And we don't know if Donnarumma's going to come in. So, what is that uncertainty a bit of a problem at the moment? Or is it just something that week by week, we'll just see what happens?
It's a strange one. So I've said this in other places that I'm not keen on the Donnarumma signing. I'm one of them who's fully bought in to the Trafford's coming to be slowly eased in over the course of the season, slowly take over Edison, and by the time Edison walks off into the sunset on a free transfer next summer, Trafford will have had enough exposure in the cup games, and then hopefully will have taken on some Premier League games towards the end of the season, so that he should, in theory, be ready to lead to be the number one for City next year. Basically, that's I'm well accepting, which is why I'm not too harsh on him for the mistake that he made. I'm well accepting that means some errors along the way. It's not like Edison never made any kind of errors.
I was going to say this. If you go back to the Happy Flowers game from 2023 and swap Trafford for Edison and Nico for Rodri, you've got exactly the same goal. That's it.
Exactly. Exactly. 100%. It's like a mirror image, isn't it, the goal? It's just like, at the end of the day, and look, how many of those did Edison make where he was bailed out by a defender or had to save it and it didn't go in? Like, it just happens when you play out from the back. It's just like a natural consequence of that. And expecting a 22-year-old who's just been thrown into the team, who's ultimately been thrown in earlier than the club would have anticipated or wanted him to be. I'd imagine at this stage of the season, in a world where Ederson hasn't maybe got one or both eyes on the exit door, that Ederson would be starting these first couple of games and then Trafford can maybe come in a little bit later. But obviously with the way things are at the moment, you don't really want to be starting Ederson because you don't know how much his head's in the game. And that's why Trafford is now sort of being thrown into his first... I'm sure the club would love for his, you know, home debut to be against like Leeds or Sunderland or something at home, where he's got a nice, hopefully easy time of things and can just sort of have a nice drama-free game. But instead, his first home game, which is going to be a thing that affects him as well. Like, I know that he's been praised a lot for kind of his mentality and determination and stuff like that, but you're not human if a home game returning to your academy club doesn't affect you and have some nerves involved as well. And you could kind of see that in the way that when he was coming off his line and stuff like that, and basically just a few of the mistakes that he made, which were a bit erratic, and if he was trying a bit too hard to impress in that sense. I think it's just his starting position was a bit off. It's been pointed out a couple of times that I think from some people who've had like screen grabs of stuff. And I think, again, this might have been a Monday Night Football thing I saw as well. I can't remember. But there would be points where Spurs would have a ball would be played through to a Spurs forward. And because Trafford was too close to his goal line, he's forced to make that sort of difficult decision where suddenly he's going into a situation where he is colliding with a Spurs player and he is giving the referee / VAR a decision to make that thankfully wasn't made. But if his starting position is a little bit higher up the pitch, then he easily wins that ball. There's no problem to be made. Yeah. So that's, again, all part of the learning process. And because I'm well on board with this being the idea, I'm more than happy to sit back and let that learning process happen. But I think we've seen from the reaction, like with a lot of people saying Trafford's not ready, like Trafford isn't that guy, stuff like that. It's like a lot of people are just wanting a goalkeeper who is first team ready to sort of walk straight in. And with when you're being linked to a goalkeeper who is as accomplished and well thought of as Donnarumma, you can kind of understand why that's maybe there in the fan base's mind. But yeah, I'm still very much all aboard the Ederson / Trafford succession plan, and I'm hoping that Ederson doesn't go anywhere so that it can actually happen.
The Ederson thing is interesting, Adam, because something that I noticed in the game with Trafford is it was the first time in years that the ground got a little bit jittery when the ball was near him, in a way that it just doesn't happen with Ederson, even as much as like the bloke behind me continually says, I wish he'd just get rid of it. And he kind of like, we're nearly a decade into this now. It's like it's not going to happen. But like the jitters were there and we're back in amongst the fans. And like it's kind of interesting that as much criticism as Ederson has had down the years for some of the things he hasn't done, it kind of shows that reaction being back, that he's never had the credit for what he does do. And actually, what he does do isn't that simple, as you said. Because you look at Trafford's ability, and you saw it in the Wolves game. I think credit to him in the Spurs game for like effectively going again and keep doing what he's been told to do, and not falling back on the if in doubt, get it out sort of thing. But like the fact that he's still there and still going to the well and still trying it, even when he's kind of struggling with it, you're kind of like, you have to buy into this, don't you?
Exactly. So with the Edison thing, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. That is going to be the perfect motto for that, because it's obviously been coached in. That's the way we play. So you don't get to enjoy the way we play for the last 10 years and then complain about it when it doesn't go right, when you've not got the right personnel to do it. It's going to take time. Edison just... I was happy with the succession plan that Joe's alluded to there. I think it made sense. And then when the Donnarumma's news comes out, you're like, that makes no sense. But if this world-class keeper's available, I think you've got to put your hat in the ring for him and then worry about what your succession plan is and what you promised your new signing goalkeeper in Trafford, what his succession plan looks like. So I think our plans have been kind of thrown into a bit of chaos with the availability of Donnarumma. I was all in on the Trafford thing. And even before the Spurs mistake, so I'm not being like knee-jerk with that, I think if Donnarumma's available, you go for him. But we're not going to play out any better from the back with Donnarumma than we are Trafford. That's not what he brings. He brings a more, you know, a fiercer approach, a fiercer presence to the maybe to the Champions League stage, which there'll be a whole discussion if we do get him, because it's on and then it's off and then it's on again. But I was quite happy with Edison to go, because you just need to rip that plaster off anyway, because no one's ever going to be Edison. And Trafford's,
it will be different when he's gone, won't it? Yeah, it just
Trafford's,
will. Yeah.
Trafford's biggest crime is probably not being Edison. Just like when Calvin Phillips came, he wasn't Rodri, so that was never going to happen. Obviously, it's since been proved subsequent loans later that wasn't the only reason. But if you're replacing someone like an Edison, like an Aguero, like a Rodri, you better hit the ground running when you do join him, because your cards are marked as soon as you don't reach those levels on your debut. And we're talking about a young lad who's not Edison, and therefore he might already have made his bed one game. And
if Edison moves at this transfer window, we can't spend the season going, Edison wouldn't have done that. Because he's not an option. It doesn't matter. Like he's gone. It's like you have to change, don't you? This is a paid promotion for NordVPN. As the years have gone by making the Blue Moon podcast, you'll have heard me record from loads of different locations. Sometimes I tell you and I say that we're outside the Etihad or in a studio or in one of the guests' front rooms. But other times, when it's a bit less glamorous, I like to keep it quiet. I've recorded from hotel rooms, offices, and even on one occasion while waiting for the traffic to die down a bit in a motorway service station on the M6. When I'm recording out and about, I've often connected to public Wi-Fi, and I do it safely by using NordVPN. It means that whenever I put in passwords or sensitive data, I know it's protected and there's no risk of it being compromised. I can connect in a single click, choosing one of more than 8,000 servers in 126 countries, and it's all set up even before I finish plugging in the mic and the headphones. NordVPN changes your virtual location, making it appear as if your device is in another country, and it means that you can access apps and websites from other parts of the world. It also means that your paid subscriptions don't go to waste while you're abroad, which could be especially useful if you go into one of City's Champions League away games this season. You could get back to the hotel after Real Madrid or Villarreal and pick up your favourite series where you left off on whatever streaming service you use. If you're using it at home as well, you can protect yourself from malicious links, viruses and phishing sites by using NordVPN's Threat Protection Pro. And one NordVPN account can be used on up to 10 devices and on every major platform as well. I use it on macOS and iOS on my phone because I'm an Apple user, but you can also use it on Windows, Android, Linux and even your Android TV. To get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/bluemoon. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan, and there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is also in the podcast episode description. Go to nordvpn.com/bluemoon.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/bluemoonpodcast.
I want to touch on briefly before we move on the centre of the pitch, Joe, because I've seen a real divide online this week. Loads of people think Nico Gonzalez was great in this game. Loads of people think he really struggled. So where do we think? Where do we sit on this? What did you make of him?
I mean, the numbers suggest that he was very good. I think after the game, like the stats that were coming out about him, like winning most of his duels stats and stuff, having pretty decent. Yeah, yeah. Who'd ever do that? Who'd dedicate a page to that? Yeah, I think you know, coming out that he won a lot of his duels. I think his passing was. Did he have the highest pass completion percentage, something like that? So a very Rodri-esque stat or something. I don't know. But it seemed like on paper that he did really well. I can't honestly say that I particularly noticed him within the game personally with my eyes. But I don't know if that's because. But again, you're in a position where, like I said before, that sort of alluding to the midfield that Pep put out being a bit strange. That asking Nico to play alone, effectively as a lone six in a game like this, where the back four against a high, the back four playing a high line, which obviously we're always going to do. That's not the problem. Isn't that we played a high line? The problem is that we played a high line and put nobody with any pace in that high line, so that as soon as they got over the top of us. Your players running back. Obviously, Aitnori went off injured, which wasn't necessarily the plan. But you've got Nathan Ake, Ruben Diaz, John Stones, and Rico Lewis all chasing it back, and neither of those are the fastest players on the pitch. Mm. And if you compound in that with only having one midfielder to protect that back four as well as that, then you're kind of creating a problem for yourself there. So I'm not, you know.
But also the goals that City conceded, Kate. One was a bad pass from Trafford. One, John Stones slipped. And it's just kind of like that's not a high line issue. That's not a pressure issue.
No, not necessarily. But then also a lot of the chances that they did create that they didn't score were a little bit of that. So it's a tricky one. But I think for me the midfield was just. If it was me, I'd have just stuck with the midfield from Wolves. I wouldn't have brought in Cherky for a first start against Spurs at home. Like it just felt a bit like, don't know. He almost bought into the hype of the final 10 minutes of that Wolves game, when it's like, oh, he scored. He must be great. Like let's whack him in.
A bit like giving an untried youngster a debut in a cup final, or taking Fernandinho off Liam the lap when you're only 2-1 down.
Oh God, yeah. There's some bizarre decisions that go on in the past, haven't there? It was just the whole midfield was kind of. A problem, really, in that sense. I wouldn't put the blame on Gonzalez at all. I'd just sort of say that it was more of a way it was set up, just didn't help him at all, and it didn't really help us in general.
Yeah. Adam, Nico, good, bad, not sure?
Amazing at Wolves because he had Bernardo's legs around him. Now, that sounded very weird.
there's plenty of people out there who want Bernardo's legs around them, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I'm not knocking it. But I think he was exposed in this one. But I think anyone who isn't Rodri would have been with that midfield of Saar, Bentancur and Palhinha. Like, they were just monsters in the middle there. So we didn't really... It wasn't the game for him to be the sole midfielder there. Like, I saw the BBC formation that was at 4-1-4-1. So you've got him on his own with them three, with their three against him in that midfield. And it was just a mismatch from the beginning. But... it certainly showed promise in the Wolves game because I've not been Gonzalez's biggest fan. I've not seen much of him last season to make me think anything other. I know he has got his fans, but he's also got his detractors, which you've alluded to there. And again, I think that this season's been a mini microcosm of that because he was great against Wolves, looked a bit out of his depth against Spurs, but that's probably due to the formation and the personnel. So sitting on the fence there, but I'm leaning more towards. Is he the one to get us winning results, getting results when Rodri's not there, or certainly when he's not got someone next to him doing his running?
Well, we will come back to that because there's an interesting thing around this for Brighton. So hold your horses on that. We'll come back to it. But first, we also couldn't help but notice that across social media, there's been a lot of bad reaction to the game with Spurs. Now, while we wouldn't want to come across as happy clappers here and suggest that everything is rosy, after all, we've just spent ages talking about the issues that City had in that game, we do want to try and calm everyone down a little bit. I've been digging through the history books to find the seasons where a defeat in one of the opening two games didn't stop City from achieving their aims that year. Before we start, let's get one thing clear. Losing a game early in the season obviously isn't ideal, but it's also not the end of the world. With 36 matches to play, there's plenty of time to recover, and you don't have to go that far back to find examples of City doing exactly that. In 2021, it was a defeat to Spurs on the opening day that puts everyone on edge.
It's normal, so it's a tough rival for us. Always I have the same feeling that we are good playing here, but we cannot get results because they punish you. Yeah, we avoided too much to make the transitions like we didn't want it, but sometimes happen. But okay, the players, most of them have 90 minutes already in their legs. We have now a long week to prepare Norwich, another one, and hopefully the players can come back step by step.
That was what Pep Guardiola said afterwards. City followed it up with back-to-back 5-0 victories, and they would go on to win the Premier League that season too. 12 months earlier, in a season where City also won the title, they had an early wobble as well, losing 5-2 to Leicester in their second game that year.
We struggled because it's normal, because it's so difficult when Jamie Vardy has to meet 10, 15 yards away from the 18-yard box. The spaces are so difficult to find it. And like, we didn't create much. We had a clear chance with Dino, but we didn't create much in this position. We start to think that, oh, we are not playing good, we are not playing good, what happened? And it was completely the opposite. We were good. But today, the result or the consequence, it was more than the fact, of course, we gave them three penalties. After that, it's more too difficult to win. The fourth from Madison is exceptional. But especially when we start to thinking we are playing bad when we are not playing bad.
Other City managers have won the top flight after losing one of their first two games of the season as well. Wilf Wilde was in charge for City's first ever title in 1937, and they began that term with a 2-0 defeat at Middlesbrough. In 1968, Joe Mercer was the City boss when the club were Division 1 winners for a second time, and they lost to both Southampton and Stoke in games 2 and 3 after an opening day draw that year. Then, in 2014, Manuel Pellegrini's City were crowned Premier League champions, and they were beaten 3-2 at newly promoted Cardiff in their second game.
We did have many problems defending. They didn't arrive too much to our goal, but scores was decided by two corners. We knew before we came here that Cardiff is a very strong team here. They didn't lose too many games last year. But we were optimistic that we could win here and have 3 points. But the reality, this is another thing.
There are other examples of bad starts in successful seasons in the club's history too. City won the second division in each of 1899, 1903 and 1910, despite losing one of their first two games in each of those years. A century later, in 2002, Kevin Keegan's City did the same, winning the second tier with 99 points and 108 goals. They'd beaten Watford on the opening day, then they lost to Norwich a week later. Here's how that was reported on the end of season DVD.
If it had been the perfect way to start the new era at home to Watford, it couldn't have been much worse a week later at Norwich. Not only were the Blues to suffer their first defeat, but injuries to Carlo Nash, Ayle Berkovic, and most seriously to Jeff Ridley merely compounded the misery. Add to that the sending off of Paolo Wanchope, and the goals of Mark Libra and Paul McVeigh were almost incidental.
Then, as a newly promoted team back in the Premier League for the next season, City lost on the opening day, but they would go on to finish ninth and qualify for Europe via the Fair Play League. After the 3-0 defeat at Leeds, Keegan spoke to ITV.
If players at this level get half chance, and the first goal from Nicky Bambi was a deflected cross, it's a half a chance in the First Division. But for players like Nicky Barmby, players like Keane, players like Viduka, and the players we've got up front, to be fair, they're chances, they're real chances, and they do tend to stick them away. So I don't think anything we didn't expect, but very, very disappointed to lose 3-0 here today. But that's life.
Other promotion years have had slow starts too. In 1989, City went up on the final day of the season at Bradford, but they began with back-to-back defeats in games 1 and 2, losing to Hull and Oldham. 10 years later, they would finish the season with promotion at Wembley against Gillingham, but they suffered their heaviest defeat that term in game week 2, going down 3-0 at Fulham. The patchy form continued until December that year. Manager Joe Royal explains why he thinks it changed.
I think we came to terms with the division. We came to terms with every game at Main Road being the biggest game of the season for the visiting side. In some ways, more than their home game, because Main Road was a stadium that they might never play on again. You know, there's certainly nothing that size. It was a hard division. It wasn't a great division.
The season after that, City secured back-to-back promotions.
But in August 1999, they began life back in the second tier with an opening day defeat to Wolves.
This is Kevin Muscat. Layoff by Robinson, a beautiful one to Robbie Keane! And Robbie Keane's deadly finishing proves yet again why he's Wolves' most prized asset.
And after that loss, City drew with Fulham, earning just 1 point from their opening two games. Even so, they still finished second and won promotion back to the Premier League the following May. In each of these campaigns, City have had an early setback and still gone on to achieve their aims. With 108 points still to play for this year, perhaps we shouldn't read too much into Saturday's defeat to Spurs. If this season is to be a successful one, it wouldn't be the first time there was an early bump in the road.
Hi, this is Ian Bishop. You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Listen to it. Drink it in.
That was a look at when City had lost one of the first two games of the season, but still gone on to have a successful year. Brighton up next. Joe, what now then? What do you want to see from the team at Brighton in terms of a little bit of selection, a little bit of performance? What will calm you down after the Spurs game?
I'd like to see the midfield go back to that Wolves midfield, to be honest. I think in a world where, let's just say hypothetically that Rodri isn't available to start, because I wouldn't expect that he is after a substitute appearance against Spurs. I think the balance of what those three brought us against Wolves was just really good. I think Bernardo gives you the ability to cover the back four as well as do a bit of work higher up the pitch, and then giving Reinders that kind of freedom to be a pure box to box, like box crashing midfielder. Great, that's exactly what I want. I'd like to see Kusunov come in to the defence, to be honest, because I think that I just want to see some pace in that back line.
Someone at Brighton needs a clump in as well, don't they?
yeah, exactly. I just want to see whether it's Stones who makes way, or whether it's Diaz.
You can't break up the brotherhood. You can't have Stones and Diaz. You can't give us Stones and Diaz back 5 years after they form the partnership and
two
go,
games,
oh, you know what, we'll break it up.
Yeah, maybe you don't bring Kusunov in then, but I just want someone with pace in that back line, and I don't know where it comes from. But maybe bring Nunes back in, a bit more of athleticism maybe, to sort of deal with that threat.
That's what I was going to say. If you're getting pace into that back line, the only way that's coming is Nunes. And that, I don't know if that's the right choice or not. I love Kusunov and I would always have him, but...
There's only one option. There's only one issue I'm going to chuck at you there, Adam, if you do that, is are you going to ask a fullback to invert? Because Ait Nouri is likely to be injured, in which case it's likely to be Rico Lewis that needs to do it.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one, because I get John Stones going back into midfield again and all is well.
From centre half.
Exactly. And just get longer studs on him and we've cracked it. those are the type of... I've kind of just hijacked Joe's answer there. But those are the kind of decisions that need to be made. It's weird that 3 games in, we're now thinking of an absolute overhaul of who needs... of the playing personnel. I think it will absolutely look different to the Spurs game. And I think... That might look like Nunes and give him a bit of a chance there. Who fills in at left back if Ait Nouri's ankle injury hasn't healed itself by then? What are the
probably
options?
Probably Ake, isn't it? I think it's going to be Ake, because I don't know if Guardiola will be fit again. We'll find out in the press conference, but I assume he won't be fit. The other side of this, Joe, we talked about the midfield and Nico a bit earlier in the show. If Rodri came on and is available to start, what does a City midfield look like if it has both Nico and Rodri in it?
Solid.
Yeah, very solid. I think then you're looking at those two sort of being a bit of a the dreaded double pivot. I think it's going to be a bit of that. But we saw from Nico, he can move further up the pitch. He is quite good in those sort of more advanced positions, and we all know that Rodri is.
If you're going to say something of Rodri doing that, then he's got a collection of belters from the edge of the box, hasn't he?
Exactly. So they're both the kind of players who can, like, one can cover for the other when they both move up and down, and then you would imagine it's got to be Reinders who's got to play alongside them. I just love the idea of Reinders, as I've sort of said, with having Nico and Bernardo playing together. Just the idea of Reinders just being let loose and just being able to just go further up and further up the pitch. Which
would they be City's bastards? As like you think of like what Adam said before about that Spurs midfield. Like would that, like, if you had Reinders in there with Nico and Rodri, is that the same sort of thing? Is that a midfield where the opposition would look at that and think, good God, we're never going to get through that?
Yeah, you'd hope. I mean, yeah, the size of Rodri and Nico as well. You would hope that would be the case. It's just a very like athletic, imposing midfield, isn't it? Like, I think one of the other things I noticed against Spurs, to bring it back to that briefly, is that they looked like they physically dominated us for most of that game. Like the difference between them and us was pretty big in that sense. So I would. If Rodri is available to start, I'm not convinced he is, but if he is, then a midfield of him, Nico, and honestly, if Rodri is just coming back for his first start, I would like him to play alongside Nico, so he isn't just expected to just get thrown straight back into being a lone six and just like, right, Rodri, back to Ballon d'Or winning form, please mop up everything for our back four straight off the bat. Yeah, I would like to see him play alongside Nico for a bit, and just so that he can sort of get his way back into the groove, and then, yeah, Reinders alongside those two.
Yeah, if he's not fit, Adam, Bernardo there next to Nico, or Reinders there next to Nico, maybe?
I prefer Reinders further up. I think it needs to be Bernardo and Nico Gonzalez there. And then on the wings, I think we go back to that Bob and Doku, try that again. And then if either one of them are failing or not impacting the game, then Foden comes in and does whatever job they two were meant to do for the last 30 minutes or so. I think if Rodri's in the team, in the squad, he starts, whether he's fit enough to or not, get that as established teams that started, and then bring people on if we can have a look, if we can afford to. So is that important? And you're just kicking a can down the road. If you're not bringing him on in this game, then why not? You know, I know we don't know his fitness properly.
I was going to say, even if not, probably just to give him a bit more rest from his injury.
Yeah, so,
that's probably the answer, isn't it?
But are we in a position to, we've alluded to not being having this time, and these are luxuries that we're not going to be afforded to when we've dropped points already at this part of the season. That's what I'm saying, that luxury isn't afforded to us now. Get Rodri in, if not, get Bernardo in, and then just repeat that Wolves performance, and hopefully we can replicate the result as well.
I've just done 7 minutes on why people shouldn't panic. There we are. Just calm your horses. You're fine. Yeah, you're fine.
That Everton game, you know, the second one where Walker got sent off, and I was furious after that, and that was so.
We got 100 points that year.
I know, exactly, and I'm a bit more at ease this time round, so I don't know what's going on, but I'll wait until the end of the season before I start crying.
Yeah. Just quickly, Adam, as well, we touched on Trafford before. Let's say Edison hasn't left by the weekend, because he's probably not going to now before the weekend, given timescales and stuff. Does Guardiola have a decision on the goalkeeper?
Absolutely. I think, do you know what's weird? I don't know whether Edison was always going to come in around this time ever, anyway, regardless of performances, because like we thought the transition would be much more towards the end of the season. But he's definitely got that decision to make. I think he doesn't drop Trafford just to show a bit of a vote of confidence with him, because it'd be too obvious a move to make now, because all eyes will be on that change. And I think Trafford deserves another chance, just because of everything that's been written about the Donnarumma situation, him being like effectively like shat on basically by the hierarchy if they choose to go that way. So I think it'd be a huge vote of confidence if Pep does go with him. And I think he will, just as I know I'm saying we can't afford to be nice, and you know you don't get these luxuries to have these type of decisions, but I think that would be really harsh on Trafford if he outs him just for he's made that mistake playing the way Pep wants to play him. So Pep doesn't abandon his philosophies. We've learned that over 10 years, he doesn't do that. So I'm hopeful he sticks with Trafford, but if Edison does come in, I think it was always going to be that the case anyway.
Yeah. How about, Joe, if the decision is from Edison, if he's gone to Guardiola and said, look, okay, end of the season, that's when I'll, end of my contract, that's when I'll go. I'm here for the remainder of the season. My head's in it. The likelihood is that Edison's going to be your first choice for most of the season. So you're going to have to make that choice at some point. On the other hand, if Edison has come in and he still isn't sure if he's going to be here at the end of the window, is the decision just, okay, well, this guy is thinking about leaving, so we have to stick with the guy that we've had in?
Yeah, absolutely. That's funny enough. That's the point I was just exactly about to make. I think if you've got a position, if we're in a position at the weekend where Ederson has, where no decision's been made on him, then there's no reason to bring him back in at all, personally, I don't think. And I think that that will be the case, because I don't think that this keeper situation is getting resolved until deadline day, personally. So I think that until then, you stick with Trafford, who you know who's got his head in the game, fully focused at City, whereas Ederson, you can't guarantee that. And then, yeah, you end up in a... And then, you know, if... come, because it's an international break after this as well, isn't it? So if it comes to this point and, you know, and then Ederson's decided that he's staying, or the decision's been made that he's gone and Donnarumma's come in, then after the international break, you can bring Ederson back in to be the number one. You can bring Donnarumma in or whatever, and you can say that ultimately that just comes through the fact that the goalkeeper situation has been resolved at that point. But I think as long as there are question marks over it this weekend, you can't really do that. Now, obviously, if somehow this week or before Sunday, Ederson has actually gone, no, you know what, I'm fully committed to City this year. Like, I mean, let's have one last dance, and then I'm off next season. Then maybe Ederson does come in at the weekend. I'd be shocked personally. I think it's easier to just leave it until after the international break and then sort of reassess then.
After the window's shut, yeah.
After the window's shut, I personally would just keep Trafford in until we know for definite one way or another how this goalkeeper situation's ending. But yeah, I think I kind of agree with what Adam said there, that if you take out Trafford now, it kills him a little bit, doesn't it? Like, you do that and it just makes it look like that all these fans who've been sort of baying for blood after one mistake against Spurs are kind of like vindicated by him by him taking it out, which isn't really what we want to see.
Yeah. Right, well, let's get a view of what to expect from the opposition on Sunday. Dan Burke's been speaking to Ryan Adsett from Talk Seagulls to find out about their start to the season.
Yeah, I think, as you said at the end there, the agonising bit, seeing Palace, the reason why we didn't get Europe, is very difficult to take, I've got to be honest. But yeah, I think it was a weird one. It was one of them seasons where there wasn't a direct sort of line graph, if you like, of complete progress. There was a lot of bumps along the way. A lot of form dips. There was runs we went like six games in a row of winning games, and then we'd go literally six or seven games in a row of losing games. So it was a bit of a strange one. I suppose you'd put a lot down to naivety. Manager's very young, as we've all heard before. You know, Fabian Hertz is 32 years old, in case you didn't hear it already. But yeah, I think we're probably in that scenario where everyone's very young, everyone's very inexperienced, and the club are also at a point where they're trying to get Europe every season. So there's a lot of misalignment across the board, but I think overall eighth looks pretty nice in comparison to maybe some of the results, like the 7-0 we got at Forest, for example.
Yeah, before we talk about what's changed over the summer in terms of incoming transfers, you've had some pretty high-profile departures over the summer. João Pedro to Chelsea is probably the biggest one, but also Purvis Estupiñán going to AC Milan and also Simon Adingra going to Sunderland. How much do you think those departures have kind of harmed the overall quality at Brighton?
No, that's a good question. I think, especially going forward, it certainly harmed us. I think you saw it at Everton last weekend. I was there. Nice crowd, I've got to be honest. But not so nice watching that Danny Welbeck performance. As much as I love Danny, and look, I know it's not his fault as such. He's being put in a position where he has to be our now sort of star number nine. And, it looked like it maybe got the better of him that day. I think, I don't know if you saw the highlights or anything, but he missed from about 6 yards out. He put it over the bar. Missed the penalty, and just overall just wasn't really in the game. And again, it's not a typical Danny Welbeck performance at Brighton. We love him. He's like a legend to us, really. So it's unfortunate, but I think it's quite obvious the fact, yeah, you missed João Pedro. He's a very good player. And you'll see it at Chelsea, obviously. He's, I said at the time, I thought 55 million was quite cheap, really. If you offered me that in January, I'd have said, my God, no way. So it's a shame he's gone, but I think, as you said about the other two, sort of, I'd call them like the lower tier departures, the B tier, the C tier departures of Adingras and Estupiñáns, but they're Premier League experienced players. You know, they're players that can come off the bench, or they can, particularly Purvis, will start every week for you. And we've replaced them realistically with players that aren't probably ready to start every week. So yeah, we're in that, again, transition era of having players that aren't actually ready for Premier League football in the spaces of players that are ready every single week. So again, it's difficult when you're trying to say you're going to compete for Europe, but have a lot of player turnover in the process.
Yeah, Carlos Baleba is another one that's been linked with a move away all summer. It's a lot of money being talked about. He's still there at the moment. Do you think he'll still be there when the window shuts?
I hope so. I hope so. It was an interesting performance the other day where he got subbed at half time, and the manager said that it was purely tactical, which was interesting to me. I thought, well, I don't think you take off your best holding midfielder for a tactical reason when you're 1-0 down. But again, he went off. He didn't look great either. So hopefully that's just a bad performance and we look back on it as that. But yeah, of course, it must be quite difficult for him with the amount of rumours swirling around and the money spoken about. But I hope we keep hold of him. I think we certainly need to. At this stage of the season, losing sort of your best midfielder, it's detrimental, isn't it, really, to the season. Yeah. But I think we can't afford to lose Belabor. I think it will have to be a stupid bid. But you never know with United. They'll burn a hole in the ground to be able to put a stupid bid in. So we'll see what happens.
Very true, yeah. And as for the incomings over the summer, so the signing of 18-year-old Greek striker Karolampos Kostoulas, I think I'm saying that right, from Olympiacos, nearly 30 million quid. That's the eye-catching one, I suppose. What are your thoughts on that signing in particular and the other players that Brighton have brought in this summer?
I mean, we've not seen him yet. we've not seen him throughout pre-season. He's not played a minute. There's talk of him playing at the time of recording this against Oxford this evening, which would be quite nice, just, you know, to get a gist of what sort of player he is. From the Greeks that have sort of reporters that have come over to Brighton since, we've been told that he's a very raw talent. He's one that's, you know, again, probably not ready for the first team, but it's big money. It's certainly big money, and they're strikers at the end of the day. And we're in a position where we've got Danny Welbeck as a lone forward, and we're potentially going to just have him this season. So I guess that sort of money, you know, equally brings expectation from fans and media. I would probably urge not to put too much pressure on the two kids, but, you know, they're teenagers at the end of the day. They're not used to England, but we sort of have to use him at some point. I mean, if we've not got another striker, we need to see something. But purely from my eyes, I couldn't tell you anything about them because we've just not seen them. But from YouTube highlights, they do look very exciting.
Take it from City fans. We got catfished by a Greek striker on YouTube once, and it's a very scarring experience. So be careful with that.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Well, we've got two of them, so we might even be able to triple down at that point.
Anyone else you're still hoping will come in before the deadline on Monday?
Well, if the rumours are true, I mean, I know I'm on the wrong podcast to talk about these sort of players, but I saw those links to Kobbie Mainoo, which would be some signing. My goodness me, if we got him, that would be unbelievable. Because he's a player that I think is unbelievable. I think they're stupid to get rid of a talent like that. But clearly United are in an absolute mess at the moment. He wants to get game time. He sees Brighton as a good pathway, according to the media last night. So, I mean, look, if we were to use that as a Belabor sweetener for next summer, potentially that would be a really nice deal for us. But I think, particularly as I said to you earlier, I think the striker thing is quite glaringly obvious. I think you can't go into season with just Welbeck fit and then relying on two teenagers. It's a bit harsh. And I think right back as well. I don't think we're quite ready there. But again, it's a very young team. It's a team that's going to be changing all year, and probably by January, you know, we might even have a completely different 11 out by that point, and I'll be talking about breakout stars that I wouldn't have even mentioned today.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, Brighton have made quite an indifferent start to the season. There was that 2-0 defeat at Everton last weekend and the 1-1 draw with Fulham on the opening day. Has that been frustrating for the fans, or was it a slow start kind of expected?
No, I've got to be honest. Yeah, it was frustrating. I didn't expect... I think when you come to Fulham, they notoriously sort of do us, and we were kind of expecting it. But I think the manner of the game, you know, they weren't really there at all. I think we should have been sort of finishing that game off by 60 odd minutes, and that should have been that 2 or 3 nil, just get it out of sight. And we didn't do that. We almost let them back into the game, you know, somewhat naivety again, I suppose you'd say. And 96th minute is no other more ruthless way of punishing you, is there, for your mistakes at the end. And they had a couple actually in that added time where they could have even nicked it. So a bit of a few alarm bells, you'd say. I think the Everton game probably exposed them a little bit more so. I'd argue we created a few more chances in the Everton game than we did Fulham. But I think when you go to an atmosphere like that first game at the Everton new ground, you know, obviously they're right up for it. Everything's going to go right for them. That James Garner goal sneaks into that bottom corner in a way it probably wouldn't have done at Goodison Park when everyone's booing. But we'll see. I think, yeah, City could be a bit of an education based on the first two games, but I'd just like to hope it's a slow start and just that, and there's no sort of ongoing alarm bells that have been raised in the first two games.
Yeah. Well, looking back to last season again, Brighton took 4 points off City last year. You beat us at the Amex. I think it was 2-1 in the end, and 2-2 draw at the Etihad. Are you expecting or hoping for more of the same this weekend in terms of the way Brighton will approach this game and similar results?
I wouldn't expect us to go beat you, because I think that's just delusion. But I think I would like to say, I want to see a bit more of a performance. I want to see us actually take the game and try and do something a little bit more than we did. We've been a little bit sort of placid in midfield. We've been giving the ball away quite cheaply. We've not really created a chance you would associate to Brighton and that, you know, beautiful football thing that everyone knows us for. We haven't really seen that, I'd say, particularly last season and this season. So I think it would be nice just to see a little bit more of that maybe against City. I know it's probably the hardest opposition, one of them anyway, to do it against. But we tend to raise our game, as you said last season. 4 points from you is insane when you then compare it to taking none. I think we took one or something like that out of the bottom six, or something crazy away from home or at home even. Our record against the big six looks great. Our record against the bottom six looks terrible. So hopefully we just associate those two Everton and Fulham games. At least we'll turn it on for City at home, maybe. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, what would you say a successful season looks like for Brighton this year?
See, I'm going to stick by it and say I want us to get Europe, because that's what Tony Bloom has said in the off-season. He said in the podcast that Europe is the aim. He said that we want to win trophies because of Crystal Palace's position. You know, it's impossible to ignore that, especially when we've been in and around the same leagues for so long. And I think we're in a better position to do it than they are. And I think that's what hurts more than anything, is we've been pipped in a world where Palace have been considerably worse than us, both on and off the pitch, for a long time. And I think that's going to be my motivator this season. We've got to get something out of these players, because I probably can't emphasize it enough to you. I think the talent we've got and the young talent we've got is extremely good. And if you don't start to then say Europe this season, something else, that pathway, that attraction to come to Brighton as a young player all of a sudden doesn't look quite as good as it did before, when you had Europa League and playing some of the best football. It just looks like they're another mid-table team, and we don't want to be that, because I want to always look higher than that, to be honest.
All right, well, let's finish with a prediction then. We have a charity bet coming up later in the show. What are you saying the score is going to be in this game on Saturday?
Oh, why do I have to do this? If I base it on the first two games, it would be impossible for me to say we'll win, but I think you're a football fan. I'm going to get to the game and I'm going to think, I'll be all right now. You know, you get the buzz, you get to the ground and think, I've got to win now. So probably taking a mixture of the negativity of last week and the sheer delusion positivity going into the new week, I'll probably go somewhere in the middle and say, we'll be all right. I hope. Let's call it this is just not right, is it? If we get a point based on the first two games, I'll be very happy. I think, in my head, I'm saying, Ryan, like, come on, mate. This is a City win. But we hope for a point. Let's get 1-1. Maybe 2-2, because we can see quite easily. Let's go 2-2.
2-2.
We don't know where the goals are coming from. We've done nothing. We've not scored from open play yet. We missed the penalty last week. But we're going to somehow score 2 against City. That's what's going
to
happen.
City's defence might be able to help you with that, especially if they play that this week.
Yeah, so. True. Yeah, let's hope so. But yeah, it should be a good game. It always is between us. So yeah, roll on the weekend.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Dan Burke speaking to Ryan Adsert. Joe, Adam mentioned a bit earlier on about the options further up. I mean, there's plenty of names there that could play a bit higher up for City. I mean, Foden came on. He could be back into the mix for a starting position. We've talked about Reinders. You've got Cherki in there as well, who, again, split opinion for his performance against Spurs. Bob's had a good start to the season. Marmoush got a chance against Spurs. Doku's there as well. Savinho might be back in the fold if he isn't going to Spurs. Like, what do you want to see from this?
I'd like to see Foden come back in. I think he's our best of the right wing options that we've got. I think obviously Bob had a really good game against Wolves. Like, it was genuinely, like, as far as like a way to start the season goes, it was incredible. But I think against Spurs, he looked like a player who's played a handful of Premier League games and hasn't really got that experience against the top level teams. Foden, on the other hand, came on against Spurs and he looked bright. He didn't, you know, it didn't come to anything in the end, but I think that game was basically dead and buried by halftime, no matter what. So I'm not sure what he could have done, but he looked great, and I'd love to see him sort of get thrown straight back in. On the left hand side, I mean, we're in a situation that's a bit like much of a muchness, really, isn't it? Like, Marmoush isn't that convincing off the left just at the moment.
There's a lot of options where there's a lot of question marks about what they can offer, isn't
exactly
there?
You're looking at Marmoush off the left and you're like, well, he's a second forward, like someone else for defenders to worry about. We saw how, you know, with in the Spurs game, he had a pretty fierce shot from like 25 yards out early on in the game that could have gone in on another day, maybe. He obviously had the chance that Haaland created for him that he probably should have scored. I just think he's a threat, if nothing else. Elsewhere on the left-hand side, you've got Doku, who anyone who follows me on Twitter will know I'm not exactly the greatest fan of. but he has been working on crossing the ball to Haaland this week in training, so who knows, he might finally be able to kick a ball to him.
Yeah, but if he gets it across to Haaland will just head it over anyway, so.
Exactly, yeah, we're in a bit of a no-win situation here, aren't we? And Savio, who I actually thought was, you know, very good off the left in the few times that he played there last season. Now, I think it's been made pretty clear by how little he played there that he is not seen by Pep as an option on the left-hand side. I'd be amazed if he doesn't come back into the match day squad this weekend, maybe. Whether he you know, comes off the bench at some point or not, who knows? But maybe he's another one who waits till after the international break. I don't know. As you say, there are a lot of options, and every single one of them has like a reason to maybe doubt whether they should be the person to start or not. But I would like to see this, like those
situations in sitcoms where one of the characters is making a big life decision and they spend the entire episode writing a list of pros and cons of all the possible options. And it's just like, yeah, pro, you know, a lot of pace causes trouble, no end product. There's just so many of these options that City have on the left.
Absolutely. I mean, if it was me, I'd be picking Foden on the right. Obviously, Haaland through the middle, that suits yourself. And I'd probably go with Marmoush on the left just as that sort of extra bit of goal threat. Brighton defensively did not look great against Everton, so you would hope to exploit that with a couple of forwards on the pitch. But I think another thing that informs this is probably also who's going to be our left back. I mean, if you've got Ake, who's going to spend most of the game sat back in our half, you're probably not looking. You probably want more out and out winger. Interesting decisions.
Adam, just on Marmoush quickly, is he a killer?
No. Simple. No, he's he looked great at Frankfurt, but apart from his goal of the season.
I was gonna say he belted one in from range against Bournemouth. He scored a fair few goals at the Etihad out of nothing, so like he can create something from nothing.
Well, is he a home player by that rationale? He's only scored one away, which was the Bournemouth FA Cup goal. So can you rely on him in the trenches when you've got to go to a difficult place? Is he gonna, you know, get stuck in and keep hold of the ball up there and get you up the pitch? I don't know if that's the role for him. I'd like to see him coming off the bench if he's going to be involved. Like I said earlier, I'm going to stick with my Oscar Bob and Doku options and then see what Marmoush can do, because he's not giving me enough examples to say that he's a killer. I don't think he's got that in the locker. He looks better in a team that's going to be running in behind and going to be you know, almost counter-attacking, which I know Pep Linders has tried to instill in City. We did see a bit of it early on in the Wolves game as well. So hopefully, if we do see some games that are turning into basketball games, he might be the type of person to benefit from those type of runs in behind. But I don't see Brighton setting up like that this time. I hope we can just prey on their inability to score to get us through this one.
Yeah, Joe, you mentioned it already. Brighton haven't won yet. They had a last minute equaliser conceded against Fulham. Ryan said in his interview there that Fulham were a bit unlucky, maybe not to nick it as well. They were probably the better team against Everton, but lost. I kind of feel like City need to be careful in this one, but also like if City are clinical, if they put away the chances, they should be all right.
Yeah, I think that we should ultimately be. It's a game that I think we should win. Really, I think that they defensively haven't looked brilliant. I think the Everton game is a good example of that, where they had a couple of chances that they could have put away themselves, but ultimately it was the fact that they couldn't stop it from going in the other end. There were two well taken goals by Everton. In fairness, I mean, obviously the mighty Jack Grealish getting two assists and man of the match. I mean, it's what could they do? But yeah, I think it's. I feel like it's a game where we should be kind of quite, not comfortable, but I think Brighton will play a way of football that might suit us a little bit. They're not a team that will, certainly not at home, sit back and sort of be stodgy and put 10 men behind the ball. It's going to be a game that maybe like spaces will open up that we can hopefully exploit and move into a little bit. But if they do a press job on us like Spurs did, then we might see a bit of a sticky situation develop. But I'm hoping that, yeah, the way that they'll play will be quite open, which might, yeah, suit us in that kind of game.
Yeah. Adam, do you record assist stats on your website?
Yeah, I have done recently, yeah. But I've not got them to hand, unless you want
yeah,
me to.
Yeah, no, all I'm thinking is I love a good assist like Grealish's
at Everton,
where they do absolutely nothing but roll it 2 yards to one side and the other player belts it in from 45 yards.
Yeah, I do record stat assists, but I don't believe in them. Unless it's David Silver or De Bruyne.
Yeah, a proper assist like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, so well, two games in, no wins yet on the charity bet. Let's try and change that. William Hill has given us three £10 correct score singles on City's games, and the winnings are all going to the Man City Fans Food Bank support group. We heard earlier that Ryan's gone for a 2-2 draw. That is 11-1 and £110 if he's right. Adam, what are you having?
City are going to win every other game and lose every other game this season, so we're due to win, and I'm back in Trafford for a clean sheet, so we're going City 2-0.
2-0 is 9-1 and £90. Joe, over to you, mate. What are you having?
I'm going 3-1. I think they'll be got to City, that is. I think there'll be goals in it. I don't think we'll keep a clean sheet, but I do think that we'll have the return of some shooting boots from us, and we'll get a few goals.
Also 11-1 and £110 if you're right. I mean, God loves an optimist from the pair of you. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on responsible gambling, have a look at gambleaware.org. Now then, we'll finish with some list of questions. Get in touch on Blue Sky. Find us bluemoonpodcast.com there. And you can email contact@bluemoonpodcast.com as well. This isn't really a list of questions to begin with. Actually, we're just kind of delving into the Champions League draw, because that's happened before we've recorded today. From pot one, Real Madrid and Borussia Dortmund. From pot two, Leverkusen and Villarreal. Pot three, Napoli and Bodo Glimt. Pot four, Galatasaray and Monaco. Adam, how are you feeling about all this? City made a bit of a meal of it last year.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a pretty much similar setup this year. I think the extended league phase just drags it out a bit more. So I'm not enthused as a fan. I've not renewed my cup season ticket for this competition, so
you're out of the Champions League scheme.
It's got too much for me now, but I think there's some winnable games there. I think if we win our pot three games, and certainly I think Madrid, Napoli and Dortmund might cause us problems, but the rest we should have enough about us. One benefit of that long extended league phase is that you probably get more time for Cherky and Trafford to bed in and get some games that way. Nice to get some new teams that we've not played against.
Love a new team.
Always good to have them to the database. I've got to add the crest, the kits, the colours and all that. So I do like that side, from the geeky side of it. But yeah, hard to get enthused about the Champions League just with the extended format. But I'll take the bonus of having three new teams to go at.
Yeah. Joe, BBC analysis suggests that City have the fourth hardest draw of any team in the Champions League this season. They've basically taken an average of the coefficient of all opponents that every team's got. PSV have the hardest, Galatasaray have the second hardest, and then Leverkusen have the third hardest, and then City come out next. It doesn't look like necessarily a simple draw, this, but then I guess that's the point of this new format, isn't it? That nobody should get a simple draw.
Yeah, I mean, Real Madrid just like won't go away, will they, for us? It's just like they're the new Shakhtar, aren't they? Every year we've got a Real Madrid game to worry about in the Champions League. Yeah, I mean, it's. I'm not sure how I feel about the new format yet, but I suppose from a neutral point of view, like every round you've got like one quote-unquote big game where it's like two big teams playing against each other at least. And like you say, that means that no one's got like an easy draw, really. There'll probably be one who looks out with a couple of teams from pot one that aren't the most difficult in the world. But realistically, you are going to get some tough games in there. Dortmund, we got quite lucky, I think. They're probably one of the easiest teams in pot one that we could have got. But obviously, then you put that against going to the Bernabeu, and does it really matter at that point? Galatasaray playing them at home is much more preferable to going away to Turkey. Obviously, the big one that we've all got our eye on is Napoli at home, which is going to be lovely.
Return for Kevin De Bruyne, yeah.
And then, the away games, I mean, Bodo Glimt, like, that shouldn't really be something we should be even slightly concerned about, other than the fact that it's a long way to go. And Monaco away, like, they're not the Monaco of old, are they? They're very much sort of...
they don't have Bernardo Silva and Mbappe like they did last time, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, there's... to me, it's a shock to me that they've put it down as the fourth most difficult, but then that shows that the coefficients are kind of not necessarily reflective of how difficult we think that these teams are to play against, really. I mean, I imagine that Madrid and Napoli are pulling up that coefficient quite a lot. But yeah, it's, as Adam said, I'm kind of not that fussed about it at this point. It's the new format kind of makes it very difficult to me. The fact that we still made it through somehow last year, with how shocking we were, it just shows that I've not really got anything to be worried about. I mean, obviously, the fact we got knocked out the following round by Madrid kind of kills that a little bit. But we'll most likely still get through to at least a knockout stage of some description, no matter what, really. So the jeopardy's kind of not there.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was an interesting draw. So...
It's a quiz on City's Champions League opponents.
There we go. We're over an hour into the show. You must have thought you were there home and dry into the listener questions, but no. We'll do a quiz to finish with. Adam, you were shaking your head furiously as the jingle was played there, so I'll let you go first. Pick a number 1 to 6. You know how it works.
Yeah. 1.
Number 1, okay. At the time of recording, assuming that he's selected, which former Pep Guardiola-era City player will return to the Etihad with Galatasaray?
Leroy Sané.
Leroy Sané, there we go, 1-0. Joe, over to you, mate. 2, 3, 4, 5 or 6 available?
I'll go for 6.
Number 6, okay. Who is the only player in City's current squad to have scored for the club against both Napoli and Monaco?
Oh my God, current player?
Yeah. Who is the only player in City's current squad to have scored for the club against both Napoli and Monaco?
Oh, it's got to be someone who's been here for a while, hasn't it, really? Foden?
No. Adam, any ideas?
I was going to say John Stones, but...
It's John Stones.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so swing and a miss from Joe. Adam, over to you. You can make it 2-0.
Number two.
Okay, City have beaten 4 of these teams, home and away, in the same season. Against which one of them did they do it most recently?
In the Champions League? Like,
yes, at home and away in the Champions League in the same season. Won both games. I mean, you got a 1 in 8 chance if you're guessing, so...
Pass. Not a clue.
No, you just guess at one of them. You can't. You've got a 1 in 8 chance.
Borussia Dortmund.
It is Borussia Dortmund.
Wow.
2020-2021 season. There you go. Beat them 2-1 home. Beat them 2-1 away.
Sorry, Joe.
So, a swing and a hit from Adam. Yeah. And Joe, I feel really guilty now because he was going to pass that question and I've basically cajoled him into getting a right answer. So you now need to get this. 3, 4 or 5 available?
I'll go for four.
Number four, okay. How many of these Champions League opponents did Roberto Mancini beat while he was City manager?
Of the ones in our group?
Of the ones in City's group, yeah.
So Napoli, I'm pretty sure he did.
I can tell Villarreal. You he played against four of them.
Villarreal he did. It'll have been Madrid, Dortmund, Villarreal and Napoli are the four, I'm pretty sure. But I think he only beat two of them. No, we'll go three. I'll say three.
Three. Ever the optimist. It's one. He only beat Real Villarreal. He beat Villarreal home and away. Against Napoli, he drew the home game and lost the away game. Real Madrid lost away, drew at home. Borussia Dortmund lost away, drew at home. So, yeah. Adam, congratulations. You are the winner. Ceremoniously, we're going to finish the quiz. You have questions number three or five. Which would you like?
Five.
Number five. With which of this season's Champions League opponents is Claudio Echeverri currently on loan?
Leverkusen.
It is Leverkusen.
And he can, three out of three.
How's that one of the questions? How have I got which of these clubs? How many of these did Roberto Mancini beat?
And look at the draw.
Who's the guy who went on loan 1 week ago playing?
I don't know.
Look at the draw. Wait until you hear what your final question is, Joe, because that's question number three. What was the last calendar year that City did not face Real Madrid in the Champions League?
Oh, my God. 2019.
No, 2021. It's more recent than you think, but it was the 2021-22 season. They played them five seasons in a row. I also wrote a tiebreak question, which I was, which I thought was quite a nice little stat. So, Adam, I'm going to throw this one at you because you got them all right. In the Champions League, how many goals have City scored in total against all eight of this season's opposition?
Ooh. 26.
No, they've got 24 against Real Madrid alone.
Two against the others.
Yeah, eight against Napoli, seven against Dortmund, six against Monaco, five against Villarreal. They scored 50 in total. There you go.
I don't deserve that win.
No, you've absolutely scabbed your way to it, but you know.
No, you do. I don't deserve that win either. So like, it's
we've used 100 players in the Champions League. That's a nice little stat.
I didn't know that. That's a nice little stat. Yeah, yeah. You should do some stat stuff. You know, you've got an eye for these things. Yeah.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast, and we're very sorry about that.
There we go. Congratulations, Adam. You know, there's a few ex-City players dogging around this Champions League run as well. There's only Bodo Glimt and Monaco that don't have an ex-City player among their ranks. If we're counting Claudio Echeverri as well as an ex-City player, given he's current player that's on loan. Real Madrid, Brahim Diaz, Borussia Dortmund, Felix Nemecha. This is a blast from the past. Villarreal, Adam, any ideas?
You stumped me. Villarreal.
If you don't know, there's no way you're plucking this name out of nowhere. Denis Suarez, remember him?
Of course.
Wow.
Yeah, obviously Kevin De Bruyne at Napoli, and as Adam said, Leroy Sané at Galatasaray. Maybe even Edison and Gundogan at Galatasaray, Joe.
Yeah, but this is it. It could be a proper reunion at Galatasaray. We could all have one eye on Napoli, thinking that they're all coming home, and then actually Galatasaray is where half the current
the whole coming. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. There we go. Right, so that brings us to an end of this edition of the Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guests for this one, Joe Butterfield.
Thank you very much,
and Adam Carter.
Always a pleasure.
We have a clip of this week's Nostalgia episode coming up. That was City fan Kieran Murray inducting Craig Bellamy into our Cult Hero Hall of Fame. If you'd like to listen to the full thing, then it's just £2 a month, and you can sign up by going to members.bluemoonpodcast.com. I'll be back next week after the game with Brighton ahead of the international break. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
He says two comments about him and then in the middle says, I'm not going to comment on that guy. We all know JT's like, nothing surprised me about him. I'm not going to comment on that guy. Just like, you said it up already, Craig. That was an absolutely delightful match, because there was that controversy and that beef. It was away against Chelsea. You just thought, like, I remember waking up dead hungover, and my mates were in the pub already and said, come on, are you joining us or not? And
oh, it was at 12:30 as well,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I stumbled in just to kick off, like just to see the handshake kind of stuff. And when Terry had treated one of our players, even though most of us have a pretty dim view in Wayne Bridge as a footballer at City, it was just nice to see the players kind of rally around. And then when you have somebody getting a brace, which is then going to lead to them being interviewed, the exact kind of person you want to be interviewed is a mouthpiece yeah. like Craig Bellamy. Like, and it's so masterful. It's so subtle. I mean, so he's done that really, really clever thing of, I'm not going to say anything about this guy, but we all know what this guy's like. So he's just,
and,
you know.
And you know exactly what I think.
Yeah, yeah. He spoke volumes about him without actually saying anything, you know. It's just really, really clever.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.